Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Craving some great 80s music? Play Virgin Radio 80s Plus. On DAB digital radio, on the app, on your smart speaker, and at virginradio80splus.co.uk.
I got my mind set on you.
Even if we're just dancing in the dark.
Love Chris Evans.
Woo!
Love the 80s.
Virgin Radio
80s Plus.
Vassos, over to you.
He's the award-winning actor who can't seem to stop playing icons. Malcolm X, Barack Obama, Basketball Ken. He now stars in the new film Bob Marley, One Love, out in cinemas next Wednesday. And Three Little Birds Tell Me There's No Exodus. He's right here. He's Kingsley Benadire.
All right, Kingsley.
What's that on, Chris? I didn't know Basketball Ken was an icon.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
I guess they are.
He's on this show,
okay.
Mate.
Nice.
So
nice.
Look, so many questions. I know you're as excited as I am, aren't you?
I'm happy to be here, man.
Generally,
I can't remember when I was last here, but it's nice to be here.
Rolling Stone magazine. Here we go. Rolling Stone magazine, February issue. Big interview with you here. You say, I really felt like I wasn't right for it. I don't sing, I don't dance, and there was nothing physically similar that meant I could really convince people I was him. Discuss.
I stand by that, yeah. No, that was my first feeling. I would love to play Bob, you know, but I just wanted to make sure that the family and the studio and the director and everyone knew, you know. I was like, do they know I can't sing and I can't dance and I'd be really starting from scratch?
Yeah.
And, you know, Jamaican patois, that's a whole thing, you know. It's so, I was just a little bit nervous that they didn't know. And so, you know, they found out and they were cool with it, so...
So you said I can't dance. What you meant was I couldn't dance. Past tense now. I couldn't sing.
No, I've had a bit of dancing this year.
Yeah, I mean, and playing the guitar. Oh,
yeah.
As I say, so many questions. Is it true that you actually... Did you turn down the role?
No. It was just before the audition. I just called my agent and was like, do they know I can't sing?
Right.
Because one of the auditions was to sing and to play the guitar.
Right.
So I was like, I better not do that.
Yeah.
Because if I do that, then I'm
not going
to get the job.
I can ride a horse, but I can't do any of those.
I can't do that. So I just picked one. I just picked Bob talking in the studio and we went from there. But it was immediately, you know, I sent the audition tape and the family watched it the next day and then they said, yeah, we want to meet him.
Right.
So then I flew out and I was with the family like almost, you know, within a week, you know, I was at Ziggy's house and, you know, I was with Stephen and Ryan and Sadella. And so it started straight away. And
they say, don't they, it's everything is slow until it's quick.
Yeah.
So this was a slow build. But then once the decision had been made, everybody was all in.
It was, we were off. There was no time to celebrate. There was no time to feel anything other than, there is so much work to do to try and become this man who he's one of the, you know, top five most recognizable faces in the planet. Everyone knows him. He's a hero. He's an icon. His music has transcended the culture. Bob is everywhere. Every shop you go into, every other shop you go into, they're playing him, you know.
Yeah.
So it was, there was a lot of work to do. And I really found Bob, you know, which is really unique in terms of like acting process, with his family and his friends.
Yeah.
So like there was all the books, but after you read the books, you're like, I need to go straight to the source.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time with guys who grew up with Bob in Trenchtown, who knew him before he was famous, and they'd walk me around the neighborhood and show me. So I was trying to absorb as much as I could about who Bob was outside of the legend. You know, who was Bob at home? Who was Bob as a father? Who was Bob, you know, in his quiet moments? What were his struggles? What did he go through? And I was able to get all of that information from people who were there with him at the time. I mean, we had Neville Garrick, you know, Bob's really close friend and artistic director who was with Bob when he was writing Exodus in Battersea. And he was in the room with me when I was trying to play those scenes.
Gosh.
So we had all of, you know, the authenticity of the movie and really representing how Bob spoke and the culture. 98% of everyone involved was Jamaican. It was just me, Anthony Welsh and Tosin Cole who weren't. So we were fully supported.
See, it's funny. It's like being at school, isn't it? Because you can do the theory till the cows come home, but it's when you do the practical that it gets in there. The knowledge gets in there. That's what you're doing. You know,
absolutely.
Doing your practical over your theory.
Yeah.
I suppose you could write the book now, Playing Bob Marley. You could probably do that.
Maybe.
You know, from a ready, steady cook point of view. You know, they get all the ingredients. Like, what we're going to use.
What
here.
Do you need to do?
So can you get over informed? Did you, you know, can you know too much about him? Because then you've got to decide which bits you're going to use.
Absolutely. I think at some point, you know, I learned, you know, don't overburden yourself with backstory that's not important.
Yeah.
So it's good to know and understand everything and have a kind of, you know, to understand. But at the end of the day, it's like, how do I play Bob within this story? And the story is really about this trauma that happened, this attempted assassination. They all nearly died, and that really happened. And then within 12 weeks, Bob had come to London and he'd created this masterpiece. And so the transference of that really intense moment where they all nearly died went straight into the creation of this album, Exodus. And I hope the audience come and they get a little insight into how that album came together. You know, Bob's so many things, but what was great about hanging out with his friends and people who were there at the time, they said he was so intense. You know, the creation of that album was so intense, and he was up at 5 a.m. and he was writing before the sun came up, and he was out running. He was really, there was this intensity that he had to like create. And I found it really interesting that he'd nearly died 12 weeks before.
Crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know any of the story.
Yeah.
I thought I knew some of the story. I didn't know anything.
Same as me. Yeah. I honestly look back and I go, I really didn't know anything at all about Bob. I thought I did. I thought, oh, yeah, he's great. I know a few of the songs.
I thought the same thing.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Bob was from the ghetto, you know? He grew up in Trenchtown. You know, Bob is a poet and a beautiful, humble, kind, loving human being, but he was also this general, you know. They called him the Tough Gong. They called him the Skip. And, you know, so there was all of these sides to his personality, all of these colours that I was finding out from, you know, people who knew him, just to make him feel as real as possible.
So if it was this sort of virtual screen, you know, like in... Born Identity, where they grab things out of the air and they put it onto this virtual screen, and what are you grabbing? I understand the two sort of main lanes were the human and the artist. Would you say that's about right? That's the two things you had to meld together.
Yeah,
there was the human being, and then there was the artist, and they were in a way sort of different beings living in the same body from the same spirit. Is it true that as an artist, in many ways, he was a bit method, almost like he was playing himself, in as much as one of the reasons he would stay up till 5 o'clock in the morning is because his voice was more hoarse then, and he preferred that sound on the recording. Is that all true?
Yes, all true, man. Bob was a really spiritual guy, you know, like Bob was a deep guy. I think he found, you know, they didn't have therapists back then. Those guys, they weren't going to therapy on Wednesdays. They found their safety in their community, in their religion, in their beliefs, in football. They found it in music, you know. So I feel like Bob's guitar, you know, really saved him as a child. That was my interpretation anyway. He found, like, he's a kid from the ghetto, and he found music, and he loved music. And you can only write that many. Do you know how hard it is to write one hit song?
I
had a go, and I couldn't. I mean, it was so bad. And I was like, Bob didn't just write one. He wrote hit after hit after hit after hit. And to the dedication and that he put into his craft, I mean, we all know, because the songs are, you know, they're genius. But
they're beyond human, though. You're right, because that's what you're describing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's beyond human ability and capacity. They must be coming from somewhere else. Because if you get the chords right, you may get them in the wrong order. If you get them in the right order, you might get the rhythm wrong. You might pick an electric guitar over an acoustic guitar. And then the lyrics have got to come on top, and then the chorus has got to go in the right place. This is it's too complex for it to happen by chance.
Mm-hmm.
This must be being channeled from somewhere via him to the rest of us.
Yeah, he believed Bob was on a mission, you know, like you can only have that amount of fire and determination and lack of sleep and commitment if music is everything to you, you know. And I that's really, I learned that through talking to so many people who were just like, yeah, Bob worked, man. Like this idea of chill out, Rasta that we all have. It's really like Bob was into self-betterment and, you know, self-care and looking after yourself and finding out what your dreams are and being who you want to be before it was a thing on YouTube, you know.
Yeah,
that was like, that was the vibe. And then obviously when you're learning that about him, obviously I picked up on so much of it, you know. It's like his work ethic was something that's really stayed with me, you know. To write that many hit songs, you have to, you know, isolate yourself and be in a kind of zone in a way, so you're ready to find inspiration from anywhere. And that's what it sounds like he was doing. You know, when he was in Battersea, Neville Garrick told me, I said, what was Bob like at that time, you know? He was like, he said he didn't really go out, you know. He didn't really go out. He was really just trying to create the album. And, you know, so yeah, it was amazing to learn about his human side, you know.
Well, they say that about geniuses, you know, they are, in order to come up with the body of work they end up coming up with, you know, or if they're still alive currently are still coming up with, you have to spend 99.9% of your time in private. Mm-hmm. But because you, what you've created is so good, it just seems like you're ever present.
Yeah.
Like
it
just
came out, like it came out of nowhere.
Exactly.
You know, and that's how I feel about the, you know, the universal ideas that Bob got to. So peace and love and unity and togetherness, you know, which is what the movie's kind of exploring, like the journey that it took Bob, you know, to get there. He didn't just wake up and come out with peace, love and unity.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So there was a whole set of struggles that he went through to arrive there. And we lost him at 36, which was a tragedy. So I feel like for me, coming in to play him, it was amazing to try and understand where Bob stood with those things. So like inner peace, you know, and yeah. self-love yeah. and like the togetherness of himself. And, you know, so the themes were working externally and internally, because the family said to me from the beginning, they want to make a deep movie. They want to share a side to Bob that the fans don't really know. And so as an actor, I was like, well, I'm all in, you know. This is not about mimicking him. You can't mimic Bob. You can't copy him. You can't choreograph him. He's a one of a kind. So it felt really good for me in a way to have all of the family say, it's just a spirit thing.
Yeah.
If we can just try, and the movie is about trying to tap into Bob's spirit. And it is a love letter from the family to their dad to say, we see you and we love you. And there's music and there's joy and there's like community and family and concert scenes and arguments and fights and everything. So I feel like it's a movie where, you know, you can bring the kids, you can bring grandma and granddad, you can bring everyone. And I feel like because there was such a commitment from the heads of Paramount, from all of the Marley family, and from myself, we all agreed at the beginning that, you know, Jamaican patois has to be represented properly in this film.
Yeah.
We can't do a version of it. You know, it's like if we're going to do a movie about Bob, we have to talk like Bob talked. And that to me made me feel like, okay, cool. I'm happy. I want to jump on board and be a part of this.
There's a great line in the film where it says, Bob's wife says, sometimes the messenger has to become the message.
Mm-hmm.
It's a killer line. I mean, I haven't seen the film, but I've watched as many clips as I possibly can.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I've seen the film.
Yeah.
And I've read loads of interviews you've done about it, but I thought, what a great line. You know, sometimes the messenger has to become the message. And then here's you having to play the messenger that becomes the message.
Yeah.
You're the messenger. About
of the message of the guy who's the messenger.
I mean,
yeah.
Come on.
Yeah.
You look at the smile you're talking about it with.
It's Bob, man. I feel like it was such a joy, you know, because his research involved listening to him and listening to his music, you know.
Hours and hours, I'm hearing.
But joyful hours.
Course,
you know, I wake up in the morning, I make a cup of tea, you know, when I was, you know, prepping, and I go, I'm just going to go walk for 5 hours and listen to Bob interviews and listen to him talking and listen to him, you know. And he's funny as well, and he had such a strong point of view, you know. I feel like one of the things I respect about Bob is that he stuck to his guns, and he really had his beliefs, you know. And he was singing. I always, like, imaginatively, you know, I was like, the reason why you can't copy him is because he's singing for his life, you know, when he's up on that stage. There was no half-hearted days with him. There was no like, oh, we just had a half show, you know. Everything was full commitment, full energy. He really felt like he was in service to something higher.
Yeah.
And you know, it's hard to disagree with that, because the music is still here and it still lives on. Do you know what's so mad? Everyone outside of Jamaica, I don't even think they understand half the lyrics, and they still feel the music.
Yeah.
So Bob's music is so powerful that, like, we don't even know half of what he's saying in them, you know? We know the choruses and we know the big lines, but I had to be really honest with myself, you know, a few months in and go, I need help translating some of the songs and some of these interviews, because you know, the Jamaican patois can be really heavy and complex, and it's its own language in a way. And even though I've grown up with Jamaicans, the patois and the way Bob speaks was something that needed a huge amount of work. Like, normally on films you have one dialect coach. We had a language team of nine people, Jamaican linguists from the university. I mean, we had a whole team, and we were trying to find a way to take bits from like Bob's interviews and incorporate them in the script, because everyone in Jamaica would say, you know, the funny thing about Bob talked the way Bob talked. You know, no one talked like him.
Oh,
Bob, he picked up words from like Europe, he picked up words from America, you know. So I was like, okay,
how were you at languages at school?
Not great, not bad. I loved French for a minute, you know. When I was 15,
French for a minute.
Yeah, I was like, I'd be great to learn it. And then I was like, oh, what it takes to learn French though. I've got to go to France tomorrow to do some interviews in French. But I think you get one of those earpieces.
I think you'll be fine anyway. So the film's already seen its world premiere in Jamaica.
First premiere.
What was that like?
It was beautiful. I found it pretty surreal. You know, I went into this state of like really calm, because I just wanted to kind of absorb what was going on and how much he means to people there. And it was huge, man. They locked down half of Kingston, you know, all the roads shut down. So it was, you know, and Bob's family and grandchildren were playing on a stage, and it was just incredible. It was, it's pretty surreal. I feel like in 2-3 years, I'll look back and be like, that was so mad. It's become normal to just send Ziggy a message and check in, and to be so close to the family. Learning about Bob Marley through his friends and family, I was like, it's so mad.
So it's surreal.
Like, yeah, anything you want to know, you could just call someone.
Did you ever imagine?
Never in my life. And I got close to playing some big parts that never happened. But never in my wildest dreams would I have thought it would be Bob, you know? I never, ever would have thought that I'd be in this situation playing Bob. It's very surreal. And it's Bob's got so much goodwill as well. It's like, I've just, you know, so many people love him. They're just coming out for him, you know?
The resurgence of his music is going to be huge, isn't it, by the film?
I hope so.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Graham Norton Radio Show.
How exciting is this?
With Waitrose.
Over on Virgin Radio.
Up and at 'em, come on, things to do. Don't cheer, you'll just embarrass yourselves. We're not bored of it yet, so it's lovely. There's no stopping them. No stopping them.
The Graham Norton Radio Show.
Oh, there's nothing nicer, is there? Nothing nicer.
With Waitrose. Food to feel good about.
I mean, what's not to like?
Saturday and Sunday from 9:30.
Over on Virgin Radio.
It can get more surreal, and it did get more surreal, because you had a Bob station, and it was referred to as the Bob station, built by the beautiful people who you were working for making the Barbie movie.
They didn't build it. The set was built already. You know, it's like on film sets where you've got so much downtime. When they say cut, you've got hours.
Oh, my God. And hurry up and wait.
Yeah, hurry up and wait. Yeah. And I was like, I got the offer to play Bob sort of a few days before I started Barbie, and I was going to be on Barbie for 3.5 months, and I was like, I can't waste these 3.5 months. I need to start working. So I just bought my guitar and my laptop just behind the Mojo Dojo castle. And when they said cut, I just start, you know, doing little chords and just getting the foundations in, you know. But Greg did not build me
the Bob station. The Bob station is like, I mean, it's out there. Let's just go with it.
No, the story keeps changing. It's like Chinese whispers. I built a little space for my laptop and my tea and my guitar.
Station,
yeah, work, a
like.
Workstation.
Okay,
yeah, it was
so
a workstation.
Funny. So funny, isn't it? I like it. It's a story that they say, what does it say? If you tell a good story, it's halfway around the world before the truth gets its undercrackers on. But
is
anyway.
That what they say?
So you'd never played the guitar before, so you couldn't sing, you couldn't dance. You said, I bet you could. You couldn't sing,
dance,
you couldn't
a little
dance.
Bit, just like when you're going out and you have a dance,
yeah.
You know.
And you couldn't play guitar. Could you play football? Because that was the fourth thing, really,
No.
He was a great footballer, wasn't he?
He could have been semi-pro. Right. I think he could have been semi-pro. I thought he could have played the Prem, but he was really good. But Bob's a lot smaller than me.
Right.
So Bob was 5'7". I'm 6'2", nearly.
Okay.
So I love football, and I grew up with guys who, you know, were scouted at Arsenal and went on to play. So I know where I'm at with it.
Right.
Bob's got a low centre of gravity. I'm very gangly and like I'm.
So he can drop the shoulder.
He can drop the shoulder. I got a bent foot. You know, you want to put me right at the back, in the middle or on the right, and just stand there and just rough people up.
Yeah.
I can't play.
A bit of Tony Adams.
Yeah, a bit of that.
It'll be all right.
If anything, so we got some coaches in. I think one from Arsenal, and you know there was a semi-pro who came in, and you know it was just about finding
looking like you might have the balance.
Yeah, I would only just do like 3 or 4 second choreographed bits, like to receive the ball, take it in, vision, pass it on. And Bob looked like Bob was great at football. You can see great footballers have vision, so it's actually about taking the ball and then seeing where it needs to go. So it was just like trying to cheat all of those things.
Yeah, the ball's done. It's a done deal at your feet. And then you have the extra capacity to look around.
Exactly.
That's the thing. Yeah. It's like when you know a role really well or the lines really well, you can start playing with them.
Yeah, you can start playing exactly like that. Yeah.
His football was like a religion to him as well as his religion.
Love soccer. That's what he said.
Very good. Mm-hmm. I love doing the voice.
He loves football.
You do all the time.
He says it so much though, you know, he's like, he loves playing soccer. You know,
every day.
I think they wake up, they go for a run, they come back, they have a juice, then they do football, and then this was at Hope Road, and then after football, they're in the studio, 3 till 3. You know, 3 till 3. They just won't come out. They played football and they ran and they.
I had a mate who played against him in Hyde Park.
No way.
5-a-side, literally jumpers for goalposts.
No way.
Yeah, back in the day.
Wow.
So how much Adidas stuff did you get?
Which one? How much what?
Adidas stuff. How much gear did you get?
Oh, I ain't had anything from Adidas.
But I mean, in the movie, you're wearing.
Oh yeah,
a ton.
No, but they never give you those. I never get my costumes. Only Samuel Jackson and Robert De Niro can do that. They just, you know, they.
Other people steal. We've had them on the show. They steal a lot.
I try not to. Maybe I should. I'm watching my reputation, you know.
We were talking yesterday because we were so excited about you coming on about the fact that he may well have been the first icon to wear sports gear as fashion wear. Not that maybe that was his intention at the time.
Yeah.
But I mean, that is very much part of the culture. It's very much a signature in the film.
Yeah, he's cool, man. Bob was a cool cat. Like he, and because he didn't try. He didn't try it. He had a couple of pieces that he liked and it was always like old stuff. He didn't really think about it. I think that's why he's cool, because he just, you know, he did what he wanted to
you
do.
You can't try and be cool.
Exactly.
So this guitar thing, right? It's apparently you play guitar for 10 weeks till your fingers bled, literally, Brad Adams. Till my fingers bled.
Not bled, but someone said to me that, you know you're getting somewhere when you get those blisters.
Calluses.
Yeah.
When you callus
so
up.
I was trying my best, you know, to just, when I started seeing them and when I couldn't feel, I was like, oh, I've obviously made a little bit of progress.
Well done. I mean, and this sort of 10-week initial 10-week preparation period you had for the movie was in fact extended in the end, wasn't it? Because of various things.
Oh, we
needed
it.
And you said, thank God.
Yeah, no, I mean, you can't. I mean, I could have taken 3. And there were days where I was like, I need 5 years for this. You know, I need to move.
You're never going to be ready.
No, you're never going to. Exactly. You're never going to be ready. And, you know, I wanted to live in Jamaica for much longer. But, you know, we had the time we had. And the family were involved. There was a huge amount of trust. Everyone involved had so much love for Bob. And so I felt really, you know, safe with, you know, but it's like having Neville there on set. I knew, and this is what I love about Jamaicans, if they don't like something, they're going to tell you, you know? So I always knew if Ziggy didn't like something or if something didn't feel right, we had the time and the space to stop what we were doing. Everyone sit down. If we don't know what's going on, let's go back and listen to Bob. Let's listen to what Bob actually said around this time and try and figure out a way to make it feel real. There's so many moments in the film. I was watching it the other day and I was like, I can see the moments where we did that and we stopped and we took the time and we listened to Bob and we just added another layer in that feels like, it, you know, honors him in a way, you know. He's his personality. This is the interesting thing about Bob is that he could be really, really tough, you know, but he could be really, really kind. He could be really, really, like, he was such a complex human being. So finding all of those colours.
He was all the onion, wasn't he? All the layers.
He was all the onion. Yeah, yeah. He was on a mad one, like, yeah.
Without being indiscreet, could you give us an example of when you had to stop and dive a bit deeper into him and say, this isn't working, or...
Just, you know... Bob's not an American dad. So if you want to put Bob in a movie, you got to be really, really careful about sentimentality and the nuance of his vulnerability has to be really carefully thought out. You know, you ask people about Bob, Bob's not just going to come and cry in a scene. He doesn't, like, you can't just have Bob crying like in one of those American films where he's just, because that wasn't Bob. They called him the tough gong. So I had to really think about safety and inner peace and like what it means to be a, to have that tough exterior, like what it means to be a workaholic, like what it means, you know, and with that, you start understanding what Bob went through as a kid, you know, and like I identified with the ghetto man, the guy who came from nothing, you know, I really understood him on that level through spending so much time with his friends and family. And I was with a guy called Lego, who grew up with Bob, you know, who knew Bob when he was 13. And he's got this studio in on Orange Street in Trenchtown. And I went down there with Lego and we were just walking around and he was just showing me where they'd hang out. He was showing me where Bob first was playing. Like, it was so mad. So I feel like, I can't really remember what your question was other than...
it was, you know, it was the nuances within the takes.
Yeah, so all of that, whenever we were doing something that had like real emotional cost,
yeah,
with Ziggy and with Neville and with everyone, it was about going, we want to be really careful about how we represent him in these moments. And Bob's vulnerability was that was the movie for me.
I'm and his strength.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the whole point.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you can come across as over hard. I haven't seen the film, but come across as over hard. But it was because he was so at peace, knowing that what he was doing for the right reasons, he sort of doesn't matter what anybody thinks in the moment because mm-hmm. there's a longer game here. There's a more mm-hmm. important thing going on here that mm-hmm. he didn't maybe have time to communicate to people because he had to get on with it.
Yeah, he said, I've got no time to waste.
And so the movie, is it half and half, half Jamaica, half London, or how does it work chronologically?
In terms of...
What do you think of the film, by the way? You've seen it. What do you think of it?
Yeah, I think it's a love letter, man. It's beautiful.
Are you happy?
Yeah, I really am. I think we, you know, there was a huge... It was a labour of love.
I was going to ask you, had you seen it? Because it's not always the case.
No, I'm the first person to say, don't ask me, because I'm watching it in a completely different headspace. Yeah. I'm looking at the edit, I'm looking at the cut, I'm looking at the scene, I'm remembering the day, I'm remembering the before. It will take me a few years to watch anything in a headspace where I can be sort of objective.
If ever.
You know, if ever, yeah, exactly. And it's not for me, you know, it's not for me. My job's done and it's about people are coming in for the first time to see it. I remember the script from the first draft. The process has been, you know, it's been such a long process and the film changed, so it's really difficult for me to say. What was the question?
So Jamaica versus London.
Oh, Jamaica versus London. Yeah, we started in London, 7-8 weeks in London, and then we had a week, and then we went to Jamaica and did the last 7-8 weeks in Jamaica.
Right, right.
And they were two completely different experiences.
And this is a film that's nearly been made a few times before finally your creation.
I guess so. That's what I heard, yeah.
Yeah, and I think various illustrious producers were... I think Spielberg mm-hmm. had a look at it, and I think Scorsese had a look at it for a while as right. well. And I think in the end, your producer was drawn to it, or the family was drawn to it. I can't remember which way around it was, because somebody said, let's not do a life story, let's do this 2-3 year story,
yeah.
Which is fantastic in a way, isn't it? Because sometimes a life can be too big, even for a really clever filmmaker.
Yeah.
It gives me goosebumps just talking about that decision.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great decision, that, isn't it?
I think so, yeah. I think so. I think this period's really interesting. Like, you know, the assassination attempt and how...
How close it came.
Yeah, I mean, they all nearly died. And there's a civil war going on in Jamaica. It was a really, really dangerous situation Bob was in. And he decided to put on this concert to try and bring a little bit of lightness and togetherness in the country.
And they didn't want it.
Yeah, people were telling him not to do it because it was going to make him look like he was taking sides with the political leaders and all of that. It was really going on. And, you know, and people were coming to the house and warning him. But Bob was like, no, it's for the people. I'm doing it. It's just music. I'm not taking sides. And then bang, it went off, you know. And they, you know, Don Taylor... I mean, he was airlifted to Miami, but the bullet grazed across Bob's chest and lodged into his arm. So if he'd have been if he'd just been a little bit of a different angle, that would have went straight for his heart. And Rita, the bullet was in her head and her dreadlock stopped it. Her dreadlock stopped the bullet from lodging into her brain. So No joke. I spoke to surviving band members who told me that the trauma of that night hasn't left them. Hasn't left them. So it was imaginatively for me, I'm going, we're going in to make a movie about the creation of this album off the back of that trauma.
Yeah.
I just wanted to find out what it was like, you know, when Bob was in Battersea, what was going on for the time at the time with him on a personal level. And I had all of the people around me to tell me, you know, I was like, I read all the books and I was like, these are just books. These books ain't gonna, you know, I got so many stories. And when you're talking to people, they give you all their sound bites. So they, you know, a lot of them have done documentaries on Bob and people, you know, everyone's
they've got their
spent
shtick.
Their lives talking yeah. about Bob, yeah, you know, yeah. and everyone loves him so much. So it took, sometimes it would take 2 or 3 hours to get past it, yeah. to try and get them to understand that what I'm trying to get to is like Bob as a human.
Yeah, it's not the anecdotes.
Not the anecdotes. I want to know, what was he like in yeah. private?
Did he do the dishes?
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Yeah. What was he like? What was he like in his most vulnerable moments? And, you know, I understand that people, you know, don't want to share that. You know, it's private and it's personal. And it took a lot, you know, of I had to share a lot. Overshare yeah. a lot about myself
yeah.
with them so that they trusted me.
Yeah, I get it.
And so, you know, there was a lot of times we ended up, you know, some conversations went on for 5-6 hours. I'm going on about all my stuff, you yeah. know, just so they were like, oh, okay, cool. I needed to convince them that I was getting involved to try and, you know, create something real in support of the family, in support of the story, you know, not, you know, I want to understand Bob in the best way possible. You can't play anyone if you don't understand them from the beginning and what, you know.
You can't have committed to anything more than this interview as well as you have done.
Your
commitment
you,
in this interview is a testament to your commitment throughout the whole project.
Oh, thank you, man. I'm on one. I love talking about Bob. I love talking about him.
Can we just change the next song for a bit more Bob, if that's all right? The One Love concert that you recreated, how was that? How many people were actually there? What's the most people you played to?
We'd done a lot of stuff before,
right.
You know, in London, we'd done some concerts, but I hadn't been on stage in front of thousands of Jamaicans. So, you know,
and that happened.
Yeah, there was when I was in Jamaica, there was a night where, you know, there was going to be a lot of Jamaicans looking at me on stage, and you know, I could feel the energy yeah. of let's see what this guy's
yeah,
got.
Gee, oh know? My god, you know? I'm not sure. But, you know, anybody would want to swap places with you.
Do you know what's amazing though? Yeah. On stage, yeah. Ziggy had a group of elder Rasta men,
right?
Who, some of whom knew Bob,
yep.
and were on stage with him, and those guys come with this magical energy. You know, I remember they came and sat down at like 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon. They didn't move. You know, we were shooting till like 1-2 in the morning. They yeah. were still sitting there. No one went to the toilet. Nothing. They just were in this zone. And every time I'd walk past them, they'd just take me in. And like acknowledge me. It sounds so
no, it
like,
doesn't. It sounds like they were there to do a job.
They came in support and love of Bob, and they believe in the spirit of him. And they were just like, "This is the guy who's doing it." And I could feel.
Let's give him what he needs.
Yeah, I could feel that energy. There was so much love in Jamaica. I was in Trenchtown, where everyone was telling me like Trenchtown's dangerous and Trenchtown's this and Trenchtown that. I never felt more loved than when I was in Trenchtown. I swear, we were in Trenchtown. We filmed for 3 days. There's a scene where Bob's driving through, you know, and the police stop him. And every time they call cut, I had to walk back down, all the way down, and would just stop and talk to people. You know, people were coming out of their houses, and like, it was amazing. I didn't really get to see, when I was filming, I didn't get to go off and do too much because I was always on set. I was always in the makeup chair. We were finishing at 9. I had to sleep, prep for the next day. So when we were filming in the communities that Bob grew up in, that was my time to like really be with people and talk to people. And I loved that time in Trenchtown. Trenchtown's nice.
We're over time, but I could talk to you all morning. I know you could talk to me all morning about yeah. this, probably for the rest of our life. I mean, you sort of want a career-defining role, and you sort of don't, because obviously you're halfway, if that, through your own career. But that's what this might end up being, isn't it? I mean, I suppose that has to be okay. It has to be amazing. Where'd you go next?
I don't know, really. I just want to just look.
Who cares? What would Bob do?
Honestly, I'm just taking one of these. I'm just trying to enjoy each one of these dates, you know, and talking about Bob. And you know what's wonderful about Bob, we went to the Brixton Pop thing the other day, and the goodwill and the love of Bob, I was reminded, I was like, people are coming to see him, you know, people are coming to see Bob, and like, I find that really, I've said such a warm thing, you know, like, this movie's about him, it's not about, like, me and my career and all of that. I'm not even trying to be, like, modest or, like, it just feels like this is a moment to celebrate him. And I always felt like I was in service to the family.
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, it was always about checking in with what they want. If the family come and told me that it's the story the family wanted to tell. So I really felt, normally you get a character or you get a job and you go, like, I'm going to make this, you know. You do your work in your bedroom, you think about it, and you come on and this is what I'm offering.
Yeah.
But with this, it really wasn't like that. It was, there was only so far I could get. And then I had to involve them. And they were involved all the way through my process, all the way through the shoot, to the last day, even to now, you know. It's really, celebrating Bob.
Well, I've got a hat on. I'm not going to take it off because I'm having a bad hair day, but I'll definitely doff my cap to you. To Kingsley Benadire, Ni, Barack Obama, Malcolm X, Bob Marley, with a bit of basketball Ken throw.
Bit of basketball,
thank
Ken.
You, mate. That's awesome. You're awesome.
Nah, it's on.
Well
good
done, man.
You,
man. That was good so good.
Thank
so
you.
Good. Still on. Kingsley Benadire spilling the beans on his new film, Bob Marley, One Love, released nationwide, worldwide, Wednesday, February 14th.
Love music? Love interviews with lovely musicians? Search Virgin Radio UK on YouTube to find brilliant album specials with some of the shiniest lights on our playlist, including George Ezra.
It won't be like this forever, so just enjoy it while it's here. It's a really wonderful thing.
And James Bay.
It's about me. It's about my relationship with Lucy. It sums up so much of what went into writing this whole album. We're all works in progress. I still don't necessarily know who I am.
And Depeche Mode's Dave Gahan remembering the late, great Andy Fletcher.
I'll be honest with you, the first thought that came in my head was, I wish I'd been a bit kinder.
Watch all that and more at youtube.com/Virgin Radio UK.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.